Pure Dog Talk is the podcast on purebred dogs. We talk to the legends in the sport and give you tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Pure Dog Talk is sponsored by ChampionshipBreeders.com. Championship Breeders is a proud supporter of the American Kennel Club, our specialty and all breed clubs, our dog sports, and the gifts of therapy and service from our canine companions. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I am your host, Laura Reeves, and I have a very special guest with us today. Super excited to introduce Jason Lynn of Afterglow Show Dogs in England. Welcome, Jason.
Hello. Hello. Thank you for having me.
I appreciate your time. I know that you're pretty busy having just won Crofts for the second time in 3 years. Yeah?
Yes, that's right. That's right. It's been a really crazy past week, but we're all coming back down to reality now and just getting on with things.
Good, 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 good. So this year was the American Cocker, and in 2014 was the Poodle, yeah?
That's right.
Excellent. And these are both dogs that you bred and co-own, correct?
Yeah, Ricky, the Standard Poodle, Afterglow Maverick Saber, and as you say, the American Cocker from this year, Afterglow Miami Ink. Both of the dogs were co-bred by myself and Michael Gadsby.
Excellent. And so, you know, I was doing some research on this and looking up and looking at your records. And one of the things that I see a real hole in terms of when people have interviewed and talked to you, there's not a lot of information about how you got here. I mean, this is a pretty high peak in the, the dog world, you know, winning Crufts twice in 3 years with homebred dogs. That's pretty amazing. And so I want you to talk to our listeners about how did this happen? I mean, this is a lot of work and a lot of years. So let's go through that.
Well, I guess the story of Afterglow is, as I say, it involves two parts, Michael Gadsby, who I mentioned before, and during the last 10 years myself. So I guess for the sake of information, I'll tell my personal side of the story. I'm American. I didn't grow up in England. I was born in Elizabethtown, Kentucky.
I knew you were from the U.S. Kentucky. Awesome.
Yeah, yeah. And I came from a non-dog showing family. I mean, we had pet dogs and things like that, but neither of my parents or really anyone that I knew was involved in showing dogs. And for me, how I'd sort of discovered the dog world was purely by accident. I had been sick and stayed home from school, and I saw a replay of the previous night's Westminster Kennel Club show, and it was the year Jimmy Moses was best in show with the German Shepherd Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
And I can just remember being fascinated by the whole thing and the crowd and the dogs and just the excitement of it all. And I just became kind of hooked on it from that brief encounter. And I started talking to my parents about dogs and, you know, nonstop. I just became obsessed really with anything related to dogs. And my dad bought me a magazine, a Dog World magazine. And I read it from cover to cover. And that really sort of planted the seeds of my interest in dogs and the dog showing world. And we sort of went from that to contacting a breeder about buying a puppy, which of course was a rough collie because everybody grew up watching Lassie and wanted a dog just like Lassie. So I was no exception to that. And we located a breeder and bought a puppy. And from there, I started doing obedience classes, junior handling classes with the local training club. I was involved in 4-H as a kid as well in school. And like the agricultural side of things. Yeah, so that all of those things really kind of fed my interests as a kid. And I don't know, I just had kind of a single-mindedness, as I say, from the time that I saw that show on TV, straight through growing up into my teenage years, and it never really wavered. I mean, I was completely obsessed and wrapped up in the world of dogs in any form, as I say, obedience, agility, all those different aspects. But also the confirmation side of things.
How old were you, Jason, when you saw that replay of the garden?
7. It was 1987.
Awesome. That is so awesome. So,
I mean, sometimes I'm amazed. And in fact, I can remember a few years ago seeing Jimmy Moses. We were standing outside together and I said to him, you know, actually, you're the reason that I started showing dogs, and told him the story. And he said, oh, could you do me a favor and apologize to your parents? So, but no, it's crazy to think that from something so innocent and accidental, you know, the direction that my life took me was all really down to that moment, I guess.
That's amazing. And so as you got older, did you show dogs with handlers? Did you just show dogs by yourself? How did that progress for you?
Well, as I say, I came up through the ranks of junior handling. And then once I got into my sort of early teens, of course, I wanted to be around, you know, handlers. I had certain people that I watched and admired. And just through that, I got involved with maybe helping handlers on weekends and traveling to shows with, you know, other people who bred and showed dogs. I actually had a friend that lived locally. His mother was a groomer, and they had Cocker Spaniels, American Cocker Spaniels. And that was kind of my first exposure, really, to Cockers. And we would go to specialty shows and, you know, go for long weekends to the all-breed shows together. So I was around a lot of Cocker people. And through that, I started helping a few different people, including Kyle Robinson, who was, in her day, one of the most successful handlers of the breed. And she's had countless best in show winning dogs and top sporting dogs. And so, you know, from her, I learned a lot of the basics of, you know, looking after dogs. So from a very ground up sort of level, I don't know, I think I sort of soaked up any opportunity I could just to be around anybody that was willing to, you know, let me do something, clean out a crate, walk a dog, hold a dog, anything. So then as I went through my teenage years, as I say, I was involved with, you know, different handlers. I did a little bit of showing my own dogs, and I've had several breeds. In junior handling, I showed Basset Hounds.
Awesome.
And I've had Golden Retrievers. During the phase when I had Golden Retrievers, I was helping Michael Faulkner and his late partner, David White, at shows as well. And I think I was really lucky because I had a lot of people.
You had good mentorship.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of very respected professional people who had a really great work ethic, integrity, talent. And, you know, they really, I think, kind of kept me on track. And if I started to veer off into a direction, you know, maybe they were the type of people that could pull me back on track and, you know, keep me focused and keep me from getting too ahead of myself. And so I definitely think the whole, you know, mentoring thing is important. It's crucial, really. I think no matter what field or activity you're involved in, having mentors who have been there and who can give you good advice and support is obviously something that's priceless. And I was really fortunate to have that.
Excellent. And so Mike Faulkner and Kyle Robinson, who else would you think of as your sort of early mentors that really kind of gave you this foundation that's been so successful?
Well, so when it was about time for me to graduate from high school, I had plans to go to university and I'd been accepted to a university. And the summer before, I had gone to help Mike and Linda Pitts, who you'll probably know that Linda last year had the top dog all breeds, the Hungarian Poolie. But Mike and Linda are really well known as Cocker Spaniel handlers. And so I helped them for the summer prior to starting university. And anyway, went home first week of school. And actually the first day of class, we had a guy who came to talk to the, you know, the new students. And he was talking about deciding what career path you wanted to go on. And he said something that really kind of struck me. He said that in order to, you know, be successful in life, find out what it is that you love to do and find out a way to make a living doing it. And immediately I just saw it as a sign that I didn't want to be at university. I wanted to leave, go back to Mike and Linda's and, you know, try to pursue being a handler or, you know, I wasn't really sure what, but I knew that this was what I wanted to do. And I really felt like this was it for me. So I wanted to give it a chance. So I came home, explained to my parents that I was actually leaving school, having barely started it. And they were obviously concerned and, you know, they really wanted me to consider it. And, you know, I'm sure they had hopes of me doing something else. Maybe, I don't know. But in the end, they supported my decision. And also, you know, I should say that although my family, as I said, didn't show dogs, and to be honest, it was all something that, especially early on, maybe they all thought was a little bit crazy and a little bit too much. They always, always supported me. And long drives, doing crazy hours and making crazy trips to get me to shows. And, you know, I really was fortunate because they did help me in every way possible. So when it came time for me to have this big conversation with them, you know, in the end, they did support me. And I think they knew how serious I was. And they backed me up. And that's what I did. So I spent about 9 or 10 years at Mike and Linda's.
Wow. Okay.
As an assistant. So that was a huge chunk of my life.
And a very good and a very positive, and I mean, you couldn't ask for much better in terms of mentors to send you off into a handling career for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're really the utmost professionals in everything they do. And it was an interesting time. I learned a lot. I was exposed to a lot of scenarios and situations and just the hands-on total immersion into that world is something that you can't really experience unless you do it.
The idea of apprenticing, that you really do immerse yourself, that you give your brain and body to the learning of a craft, I think is something that's sort of fading away, unfortunately. How would you think about that?
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, I think people want to bypass the hard work and bypass the struggle and sort of just get to the fun bits, which is winning or however people define success. And it's true, that part is fun. But the reality is 90% of that takes place outside of the ring, you know, outside of the spotlight of the dog show. And most of what you see is the result of what goes on at home and the hard work behind the scenes. So it isn't as fun, it isn't as glamorous, but it's crucial. And I don't see how you can have one without the other. And even the people who I think, you know, who have found a way to kind of cheat the system or, you know, have kind of bypassed that route, I really think they've not got the complete picture, in my opinion, because, you know, I think until you've done something from the very ground up and you're capable of doing all aspects, I don't think you have the complete knowledge of any subject.
Absolutely. Absolutely agree. So you're actually covering one of my questions here, the secret to success, your success specifically. And I want to have you finish your story of how you wound up in England. I had some very specific questions that you can give some of our listeners ideas on exactly what you're talking about. Some of that hard work, how to do some of the coat management routines, how to keep a dog fit while it's in coat, stuff like that. So let's finish up the journey to England, shall we?
Yeah, well, as I say, I'd been at Mike and Linda's for, you know, 9 or 10 years. And through kind of a series of accidents, I ended up meeting Michael Gadsby. And after a few months, decided to leave my job at Mike and Linda's and move to the UK. Mike, you know, as most people probably know, was already a well-established breeder and exhibitor himself. He'd had a lot of success in the UK, you know, several times top dog all breeds, reserve best in show at Crufts. So he was already someone who was quite well known in the world of dogs here.
Yes.
And I think I was kind of burned out of the sort of monotonous schedule that American dog shows can be when you're doing it 24/7, 365 days a year.
Oh, yeah.
And I was just kind of at a turning point in my life. And yeah, so it opened up a whole new world to me. And I started to see things from a completely different perspective. So I'd had the, I guess, the handler's viewpoint. And I think the biggest thing that I've probably learned from being here in the UK the last 10 years was to see things from a breeder's viewpoint. And I think it's made me more well-rounded, and it's just sort of changed my perspective on things, I guess. So yeah, so I came here in 2006. So I've been here for about 10 years now, I guess. And yeah, as I say, being here and immersing myself into the breeding aspect of the world of dogs has, you know, given me a new point of view. And the show scene here is very different. There's much fewer shows. I mean, I think there's probably about 30 or so all breed shows a year.
Right. Way different.
So yeah. I mean, it's dramatically different. There's much less professionalism in terms as, you know, handlers. There are professional handlers in the UK, but it's really geared more toward the breeder, owner, handler in general. There's just a different feel. It's much more relaxed. Although the shows are huge, I mean, some of the shows have as many as 8, 9, 10,000 dogs.
What, Crufts was 22,000 this year?
Yeah, Crufts is the big one with over 20.
Crazy.
But even our regular all breed shows are enormous. But yet they're much more laid back. They're a little bit more informal. We don't have electric hookups to use dryers. It's not quite as polished and professional in terms of the presentation. Although, you know, there are great handlers here who present their dogs fantastically. The whole thing in general is a bit more laid back.
Very good. And I'm just thinking about doing up a poodle or a cocker without power, and my head is spinning. I'm sorry, I'm distracted with that.
Yeah, you learn to adapt.
Wow. That's mad props right there, man. Okay, so I love what you're talking about, the idea of being able to see the whole thing from both sides, from a handler's perspective, from a breeder's perspective, because I think that's something that some of us that have that ability, I think it does, like you say, bring a very well-rounded and different perspective to the whole thing, to the whole part of dog shows, because you can see all the sides of it. And I think we'll take it in bits and pieces when we're talking here for a second. Let's talk about the breeding programs, because I know Mike Gadsby had pretty well established the poodles, correct?
Yes, really my first experience with poodles was when I moved to England. So that was something that he had already started. And in fact, the dog who we showed after Glow the Big Tees, he had been in the U.S. and he was best in show at PCA from the classes with his handler in the U.S., Michael Pawasarat. So not long after I came here, Donnie came back to the U.K. and he was kind of the first big winner that we had after I arrived here. So he was already in the works before I came.
Right. And so when you're talking about these breeding programs and, you know, you've spent the time now working, looking at it from a breeder, we can kind of work our way backward. What are you seeing that's making these dogs? What kind of crosses, what kind of breeding program are you working with that's giving you this quality? What are you seeing come through?
Well, that's possibly a complicated, difficult question to answer. I think
It is.
And maybe it's different from breed to breed, but I think in general, Mike, I think, has a really fantastic eye for seeing the potential in a dog and seeing a potential breeding in his head before it even happens. And his foundation in poodles was from a kennel called Torpaz, who have been really influential with several breeders around the world. But Mike had two bitches from her kennel, and everything that we have in standards goes back to one of those two foundation bitches. There's been like a continual line that's come down from those original two purchases. And I don't know, I think breeding is a lot about, it comes down to it, selection and how you select not only potential stud dogs or brood bitches, but how you select puppies and how you select what is in front of you. And
absolutely,
sometimes you have to be really hard on yourself and you have to be completely honest with yourself. And no matter how much hope or expense or whatever you have riding on a certain litter or a puppy, I think what separates, you know, really good breeders from the rest are the ones who are able to say, you know, actually, although this is the best puppy in my litter, the litter really isn't good enough. You know, I didn't get what I wanted from this combination, even though I spent a fortune importing semen or sending my bitch abroad, or, you know, no matter how much effort has gone into it, I think you have to be realistic enough to say it worked or it didn't, and not kind of fool yourself into believing that something is what it isn't just because you're emotionally or financially wrapped up in it. So I think that's really one of the things that I've learned, and I think it's something that Mike's really good at, to sort of say, you know, call it a day when it just hasn't worked out, instead of convincing yourself and being guided down a path that really you shouldn't be going down if you'd had the clarity just to say at the start of it, no, this didn't work. Let's go back to the drawing board.
Right. No, I think you are dead on. I think that is so accurate. And I think that clearly you guys are seeing the success that Mike's bringing to that vision for sure.
The Cocker side of things has been a little bit different because, although, as I say, when I came here, the poodles were already well underway. Miami, for example, the dog who just won Crufts, he is line bred on a bitch who I brought with me when I moved here. And she actually had a litter in quarantine because at the time, England still had really strict quarantine laws, which required a 6-month wait after the rabies shot and blood titer before the dogs were able to enter the UK. So before I moved here, I sent a tricolor bitch who had won the Futurity at Spaniel Club and had been best of winners at ASC. And she was in whelp actually to a dog that Mike had bred and sent to Mike and Linda in the US. So she arrived at the quarantine kennel in whelp, had the puppies in quarantine, and, you know, from that combination and a previous litter, we, several generations on, sort of Miami is the result of that.
Very nice. Very, very, very cool.
So, I mean, it was nice in a way because it's been like a continuation of something that I started even before I came here, and something that we built on once I arrived and once the dogs got here. And so it was really special, I don't know, to win with the Cocker Spaniel, because that was kind of where it started for me. And honestly, for Mike too. I mean, we both started in American Cockers. So to have had this significant win with an American Cocker was pretty special.
That is very cool. And to see what you started, you know, that dream come to fruition, I mean, that's amazing. Absolutely fabulous. So let's talk a little bit about now kind of, if you will, the handler side or the in-between side. You're working with hair. I mean, good Lord, you've got poodles and cockers and dog shows with no electricity, did I say? I'm still having a hard time with that. So talk to us about managing all that hair. And that's a lot of hair. What does your day look like? I mean, you've got a brush from 7 to 7 every day.
Yeah. I mean, we don't keep so many dogs in coat. I mean, one of the things about showing in the UK is, as I said before, we don't have so many. And at those shows, one bitch seat breed, most shows. So there's kind of a limit to how much you can expect to finish in a year in terms of champions. And if the dog, like Ricky, for example, the poodle that I showed, he won most of the CCs in males that year. So for other people who were showing males, there was no opportunity for them to finish their dogs. So sometimes I think in the U.S. where you might think, okay, we'll finish this one and then we'll bring this one out and finish that one and then we'll finish this one. And you see litters where entire litters are finished. You know, take nothing away from the quality or whatever they might be. That's just not feasible to try to do here. And if you win the dog ticket, I think there's kind of a psychological disadvantage of you winning the bitch ticket.
Yeah, that's similar here. I mean, you go winner's dog or winner's bitch, you're not winning the breed.
Yeah, so, and I don't even think it would be healthy for the dog world here, because at the end of the day, I don't think it's good for any one person to kind of monopolize everything. So really, even in the situations that we've been in the past where we have won both tickets, it's not really something that we try to do. I mean, it's sometimes, we choose to focus on one and not try to overwhelm ourselves with trying to win everything. So in that sense, you know, we don't keep loads of dogs in coat. Sometimes it's a matter of choosing which one we want to focus on, and everyone else has to suffer a bit, because I mean, we have some standard bitches here that are champions in everything but name, because we've never really even shown them, but they're absolutely champion quality and they would finish their titles. But maybe the timing was bad, or maybe we had another bitch at the time, or, you know, for various reasons, some of them just don't get their time in the ring, which is unfortunate. But it's also, I think, good in a way, because it really forces you to be super, super, super selective about what you show.
Right. That was definitely concentrate your energy on the best one, for sure.
Yeah, but we do have, you know, usually one or two standards in coat, a toy poodle or two, usually an American Cocker. And, you know, we have other breeds who aren't quite as demanding, but still require grooming, Shetland Sheepdogs and Papillons. So, yeah, I mean, we do a lot of grooming. And we also have a boarding kennel and cattery, boarding and cattery here as well. So pretty much from the time we wake up until, you know, work's done at the end of the day, it's full on dogs in some aspect, but definitely a lot of grooming.
Absolutely. And I think if you're a dog person, like you said at the beginning, you do what you love, then you don't work a day in your life, I think is kind of an accurate statement sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I feel really lucky, as I say, to be able to do this. And, you know, I think when you're working at something that you really love, it doesn't feel like work. So in that sense, I'm very fortunate.
Jason, thank you very much for your time. And in closing, would like to talk a little bit, just briefly, where do you see, I mean, this is the pinnacle. What's the future? Where are you going with this, Jason?
Well, to be honest, you know, what happened this past week, and I guess no one ever sees it coming, but, you know, really, it was a shock, because when we had Ricky at Crufts for his last show, he had been top dog all breeds and he had made a name for himself already. And, you know, we went to Crufts with some expectation of what might happen, what could be. And there was a lot of excitement prior and a lot of hoping and praying and wishing and everything else. And it was a bit different this year. Well, it was a lot different this year, because Miami had previously been to 8 shows in his life.
Yeah, that's insane.
Most of them specialty shows. So it was not really something that we even, you know, remotely saw on the horizon as a possibility of an outcome. So, you know, but saying that, when we were in the group and when we had won the group, I was just thinking to myself, I bet nobody saw this coming, least of all us, but people had not seen this dog. He had been at home since the fall and no one had really seen him. I don't think he was on anybody's mind as a contender for anything. So, you know, when we won the group, it was incredible. And to have won Best in Show with a completely or relatively unknown dog, it was totally different feel than the win with Ricky, because, as I say, it was just so, it just felt completely out of the blue.
Where do you go from there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on how you view things. I don't think we view things in terms of actual wins or like we need to tick boxes, or I think it's about, as long as you're excited about the next breeding, as long as you're excited about a new puppy coming along, as long as you still feel motivated to keep trying to breed beautiful dogs. And I think that's where you go next. You know, it was wonderful and the high of that win was great, but equally we're thinking already about the next generation, you know, finding a nice bitch to breed him to, you know, who are we going to breed his mother to next season? You know, those kind of questions start coming into your mind. So all of that just takes care of itself. So in the day that it stops being interesting, the day that it stops being something that you look forward to and get excited by, then, you know, hopefully I'll have a career change or do something else, because it wouldn't be worth it, the amount of energy and time and amount of yourself that you give to this, if it wasn't really like a burning passion. So, you know, as long as that passion continues, we'll just keep plugging along and see what happens next.
I think that's a great plan, Jason, and I expect that you guys will continue to find that horizon. I think that's pretty amazing. So
thank you.
Congratulations and best of luck in your coming endeavors. And thank you so very much for taking some time to talk to us today.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
As always, if you have any questions or input, we'd love to hear from you. The show notes and links to resources on today's topic are available at puredogtalk.com. Drop us a note in the comments or email to laura@puredogtalk.com. Remember, guys, this podcast is for you. So if you want to know something, give me a holler. We'll do a podcast for you. If you wouldn't mind, you could help me out here. Take a couple minutes to visit iTunes and give us a review. This will help share the love with others out there in the sport. This has been Pure Dog Talk with your host, Laura Reeves. We hope you can join us next time as we continue on the journey to success with your purebred dog.